and it will be made available. This is being recorded, and it will be made available at a later time, and it should be on the Virtual Region website. But there will be a few times during the meeting, during the workshop, where there will be time that you can share. There will be a writing prompt, and you'll have an opportunity to share that. And I just want to let you know that when you are speaking in the workshop, sharing what you've written, you will not be recorded. So our speakers are being recorded. However, if you're a participant in the workshop sharing, you will not be recorded. And if you want to ask a question during the course of the workshop when we're in the sharing time, but you don't really, or you want to share your bullet points, but you don't want to do it publicly, feel free to please send it to me, Paul G. in California, and I will share it for you. We will have limited times for sharing, but that is a valuable part of the workshop. So unless I've missed anything, I'm going to launch into our preamble. So the circle reminds us that the study of the big book never ends. And that's the steps, that the steps never end. People who have relapsed have stopped taking actions of unity, service, and recovery. These actions are for ourselves and for others in a never-ending series of action after action after action. When the food finally goes in our mouths, we say, oh my God, that's the start of my relapse. No way. The start of the relapse is when we stop taking those vital actions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our two speakers today. And I'm really, really excited for you to meet both of them and to hear this. So it's over to Gail and Rita.
Hi guys, can I help you?
Hi everybody, my name's Gail and I'm a compulsive overeater.
I'm Rita and I am a compulsive overeater as well.
So we're just going to start off this session by saying the set-aside prayer. So I'm going to say it slowly so that you can follow along. So please say this prayer to the higher power of your understanding or indeed lack of understanding. My beautiful, loving higher power, please set aside everything we think we know about you, ourselves, others, and our own recovery, to open our hearts and our minds to a new experience with you, a new experience with ourselves, a new experience with others, and a much needed new experience in our own recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So now we're going to go into the workshop. So as I said before, my name is Rita Q. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. And we are here today to talk about relapse, which, believe me, I could have a PhD in at this stage. So if you want to put up the first slide, the introduction to relapse, Tina, if you can. So what is relapse? So the definition in a dictionary of relapse in the Collins English Dictionary is that it comes from the Latin, which means re means the back and labi means to slip, which is to deteriorate after a period of improvement and to return to a less active or worse state. And notice the word active there is very, very important. Relapse is just a symptom of the disease of compulsive overeating. So if we move on to the next book, so ever in the next slide, everything we're going to talk about today is probably centered around the big book because we are big book sponsors. Neither of us are alcoholics, but I just want to make it clear that's where our real recovery came in. So if we look at page 120 of the big book, and we give you a quote, it says, though it is infinitely better that he have no relapse at all, as has been true with many of our men and many people who come into OA, this happens not to be the story of Gail and I. We both have a history of relapse. And it says, it goes on to say, it is by no means a bad thing. In some cases, your husband will say at once he must redouble his spiritual activities if he expects to survive. This is our story. This is exactly what we did. So we are now going to explain, Gail is now going to explain how she got well. So I'm going to introduce Gail. Gail first came to OA in February 2008, and we became firm friends straight away. And it has been absolutely wonderful having this journey with her and sharing this. And I think that's the one thing, you know, that says in the big book, we are people who ordinarily wouldn't meet. But when we do, there's just something wonderful that happens. So I'm going to hand it over to my beautiful friend to tell your story, and I'm going to step to the side. Thank you.
Thank you. So hi, everybody. As I've already said, my name's Gail and I'm a compulsive overeater. And my story is going to primarily focus on how I went into relapse and some of the things that I learned, because actually, if I can help somebody to avoid some of those pitfalls or give people hope who might be in that place, then my job is complete today. So there's just a couple of things that I always say before I share my story. And the first thing is that this is just my story. So if your disease manifests itself different to mine, if it shows up differently to mine, then please don't be put off by that, because I absolutely guarantee there are people in these rooms that will have your story. So try and look for the similarities and not the differences. And then the second thing that I always say is my experience, strength and hope is very much my own. But a lot of what I share about is stuff that I've heard in these rooms, that I've read about, that I've listened to on podcasts, that has really resonated with me and is very much part of my recovery. And that kind of feels like a really lovely circle of recovery that I'm able to pass that on. So much of what I talk about is not kind of original Gail. So just in terms of a quick potted history, as Rita said, I first came to OA in 2008 and I'd had a 20 plus year battle with food at that point. I was a binge eater and I'd eaten myself up to a weight of 309 pounds. I had 5 years really incredible recovery on all three levels, including a physical weight loss of 140 pounds. I was, you know, working the program really hard to about 6 months before I relapsed, and I'll talk about that in a bit more detail. And I then had a 7 year relapse that I genuinely thought was going to take me out. That took me to a top weight of 345 pounds, and I have been back in the rooms since March 2020, and I've released around 168 pounds in that time. And I'm really glad to be here talking about relapse. And I want to say straight away that relapse is not inevitable. It does not have to be part of your story. Very much a part of mine and Rita's story, as we said, but it doesn't have to be part of your story. But that 7 year relapse was genuinely the worst time of my entire life. You know, I thought the disease was bad when I came into OA, but after having recovery for 5 years, it had just gone to a completely different level. And you know, the physical consequences of relapse were absolutely terrifying, but the spiritual death was soul destroying. The shame that I felt was all consuming, and I felt that all I could see were people in these rooms who got it, and I was the person who couldn't get it. No matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't get it. And the one thing that I knew worked, because I had evidence that it had worked, I just couldn't connect with. And that's why I feel so passionate about talking about relapse, because I think that shame could have kept me away. So my story is going to focus on how I lost my connection with my higher power and what happened to me. And I really, really understand that bit in the promises that says, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. Because I know by talking about relapse so openly, it helps people and hopefully gives people hope. So somebody's just going to share a few photographs just to give you a bit of a context of my journey. So the photographs will show me as a child and in my early 20s when I got married. I was a healthy body weight at that point. Just hang on till they come up and you know what I'm talking about. There we go. So yeah, the top two photos on the left show me as a child and in my 20s when I got married. And then a picture, I was actually in Paris there celebrating my 40th birthday. I use the word celebrating very loosely because I was utterly, utterly miserable and just couldn't wait to get home.
And then the last picture on the top right is when I came into OA in 2008. I'd been in the program about maybe 4 to 6 months then, and that was actually at my beautiful friend Rita's wedding. And I remember that was the first dress that I had bought in a kind of ordinary sized clothes shop for many years. The bottom left is a picture when I was in recovery from probably 2009 to 2013. The middle two pictures at the bottom are of my relapse during the 7 years that I relapsed. And then the last picture on the right is taken a few weeks ago. So that just really kind of gives you an idea of what this disease did to me. And I show those pictures not from a vanity perspective. I show those pictures because what those pictures show me is that I do have a disease, because if I had a choice in my eating, then I wouldn't have done that to myself. And it's also a really good reminder of where self-will gets me, and an even bigger reminder that I've got a higher power in my life, because I cannot do this. You know, that last picture and the person that sits in front of you today is not here by my own hand. So when I'm not connected with my higher power and I have no defense against the food, then my life is really, really difficult. So if I'm awake, I am either eating or I am being tortured by food thoughts. I just cannot stop binging. And I know that at my top weight, this disease had not finished with me, because I know I have the capacity and the capability to eat myself to death. I tried absolutely everything with the exception of surgery, and I'm sure I would have got to that point eventually. And the insanity was that I truly, truly believed that it was going to work this time. And I'm talking about joining pay and weigh slimming clubs in excess of 60 times. Seriously, that is how crazy I was. This is going to work. It's going to work this time. It's going to work this time. And I swore off so many times. You know, I did a lot of binging at night when my hubby had gone to bed and I was on my own. And I'd go to bed feeling so physically horrendous. And I would swear that that is the last time I was going to binge, and I would really mean it. And I would get up in the morning, get in the shower with that same resolve. And then by the time I was in the kitchen, I would just be eating a mountain of sugar for my breakfast. And that is what I did day after day after day. And I was constantly full of fear, resentment, shame, anger. I just felt so full of self-loathing. It was horrendous. And if you were looking at inward into my life, you'd probably think, well, yeah, she's obviously got a weight problem, but she seems to kind of have her act together, because I had a really good job. I've been married to a really great guy for 35 years. I've got two great kids. But it was just horrendous. I might have been capable in many areas of my life, but when it came to the food, it just brought me to my knees time and time again. And I realized today that I was eating against my will. You know, I have this really powerful, seductive voice in my head that tells me I need to eat certain foods. And then when I eat those foods, I just cannot stop. And I am just, you know, I am eating against my will. And I was just totally terrified by the power that food had over me. And it was like trying to hold my breath. You know, I can take a big intake of breath and hold my breath, but at some point my body is going to take over and push me to breathe. And that's what it felt like when that craving came, when that urge came. And I felt totally abandoned by my higher power in those years, absolutely, totally abandoned. And my journey into relapse was relatively subtle. And I couldn't see it. And that's why I feel really passionate about good sponsorship and being surrounded by people who are going to hold a mirror up and tell me it as it is, because I cannot see that. I can only see that stuff in the rearview mirror. And there's a sentence on page 48 in the big book that talks about sometimes acceptance and surrender is a tedious process. And that is exactly what my 7-year relapse felt like. And a couple of definitions of tedious are long, tiresome and weary. And that is how my 7-year relapse felt. And, you know, I'd had 5 years really good recovery. As I've said, I was emotionally and spiritually well. I was physically transformed. I was living in steps 10 and 11. So I wasn't blocked from a higher power. And I was doing lots and lots of service. But then a number of things started to happen. And this disease is so subtle and powerful. It's like being near the edge of a cliff in fog I couldn't see that I was about to fall off the edge of the cliff. And I just did that spectacularly because I distanced myself from my higher power, and therefore my ego was running the show. And there's a really, really good reminder in one of the stories at the back of the big book on page 450. And it says, "Then I realized that I had to separate my sobriety from everything else that was going on in my life. No matter what happened or didn't happen, I couldn't drink. I couldn't compulsively overeat. In fact, none of these things that I was going through had anything to do with my sobriety. The tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse, both good and bad. And I cannot allow my sobriety to become dependent on these ups and downs of living. Sobriety must live a life of its own." And that is one of the really big things that I learned in relapse. So there was a number of things that happened as I went into relapse. And the first thing was that I lost my humility. Because life was so good, I started to think that this wonderful life recovery had given me was a Gail job and not a God job. Binging became a distant memory, as did my morbid obesity, and I began to grow apart from my higher power, and that spelt absolute disaster. And why was that? Well, because I have a physical allergy to certain foods, and I'd put those foods down for 5 years, so I hadn't triggered the physical allergy, but I also have a mental obsession that insists I eat those foods. And keeping close to my higher power keeps that mental obsession at bay one day at a time. But if I lose the connection with my higher power, I've no way of resisting those food thoughts. I'm powerless, and therefore I will succumb. And that's what it says in the big book. And one of the definitions of succumb is to give way to a superior force. And that is what my binging and my craving felt like. And I've heard a lot of people say in these rooms that the size of my body bears absolutely no resemblance to the size of my disease. And that's why today I have to keep really close to my step one experience so that I don't forget who I am. The second thing that happened to me, I stopped seeking growing my relationship with my higher power. And Jim's story on page 35 makes that really clear. It says he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And on the top of page 63, we're told that our higher powers will provide what we need if we do two things. The first thing it says is we need to keep close to our higher power, which is working the steps, particularly 4 through 9, and then living in 10 and 11. And the second thing is it says we need to perform our higher power's work well, which is basically step 12. And I completely stopped doing those things very, very gradually, so gradually that I didn't notice. I put work in front of recovery and it became all consuming and left little time for recovery. I went to less meetings, I sponsored less, I spent less time speaking to my higher power. And as a consequence, Gail's world grew and God's world grew smaller. And again, I've heard it said in these rooms that step 10 is about watching for me. And it enables me to clear that channel so I'm not blocked from a higher power. Step 11 is watching for God and it fills that channel up. And then step 12 is watching for others and that empties my channel so that it can be filled up again. And I think that's just a really beautiful analogy for steps 10, 11 and 12. I wasn't using sponsorship. That was the third thing. So I had little accountability and little objectivity in my life. And I know today that strong sponsorship is absolutely vital to my recovery. And today I need to commit my food. I need to share my evening review daily. I need to be honest with my sponsor about what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling and what I'm doing. And I need somebody to look at what's going on in my life and hold a mirror up, because the mind that created the problem cannot solve the problem. So I cannot trust my own thinking and I can't think myself into right action. I've got to act myself into right thinking. So what happened to me without strong sponsorship? Well, I was on holiday in New York and I thought I could eat a substance with sugar in for breakfast. It didn't say that in the title, but that's basically what it was. I know that my current sponsor would be saying, "What are you doing eating that for breakfast?" But without that sponsorship, I thought it was okay. I sensed it wasn't too smart, but my thinking overruled that. Without strong sponsorship, I think I can go for days without sharing my fears, my resentments, my dishonesty and my selfishness. And I forget that step 12 gives me insurance against relapse. That's what it tells us in the big book. And I firmly believe that I need to be inconvenienced by service and particularly working with others. And I decided that I didn't need to follow the instructions. And that is one of my defaults. If I get something that's flat packed, I'll try to start making it myself before I look at the instructions, because I think I know how to make it. And, you know, my level of denial is such that I have actually driven on a flat tire thinking it will sort itself out. So that is my kind of default when I'm left to my own devices. And the last thing was that I forgot who I was and who are my tribe. So, you know, I have a blip in my brain that means the bit of my brain that keeps me safe from walking out in front of a moving car does not work when it comes to food. And that is why I have the capacity and the capability to eat myself to death. And the horrendous physical consequences of my overeating are just not enough to stop me. You know, I got to the point where, you know, it was really difficult to stand up for any length of time. I avoided going upstairs at all costs. It was really difficult to wash myself properly in the shower, but none of that was enough to stop me. And it says on page 39 in one of the stories in the big book, it never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so when he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. And that's because the disease is in charge and not me. So I'm just going to finish off with just summarising a few things that I learned, because I really found my truth in relapse. And the first thing was that I know today that I either need a hell of a lot of food to live my life or I need a lot of recovery. And that is my truth. There is no happy medium. There's no in between. I am either in the food trying to kill myself or I am in recovery. It also taught me that I only have this moment. You know, when I woke up on Christmas Day 2013, I never dreamt that I would be going to bed in relapse. And my 5-year recovery just evaporated in an instant. I was just sucked back into the disease like quicksand. So I only have this moment. And I heard somebody say that our higher powers light our way with a pen torch, not a floodlight. And I think that's so beautiful. And just having that discipline and that connection to just be in this moment, because that's all there is. I learned that only a spiritual solution will work. You know, my problem is that I have a spiritual malady. I have a disordered thinking process, and working the steps restore me to order and sanity. And I need the steps because when I'm in the food, I am everything it describes in the big book: restless, irritable, discontent. I'm in the bedevilments. When I put the food down, all of those things get 100 times worse. So that is why I have to work these steps quickly to get that spiritual awakening. I've already said this, but I think it's so important. I'll just mention it again. You know, I enter into a contract with my higher power in step 3. And my higher power gives me what I need, i.e. this beautiful life of recovery. But I have to do my part. And that is to keep close to my higher power, which, as I've said, 4 through 9, then living in 10 and 11. And then I have to work with others, because I have to perform my higher power's work well, and that is my purpose in life. And if I do those two things on a daily basis, I get this incredible reprieve from my obsession. The longer I'm in recovery, the harder I need to work. That has been my experience, because I have a built-in forgetter. I can forget I'm a compulsive overeater. My life's really good. You know, I'm not having physical challenges anymore. I've not binged for, you know, a couple of years. All of those things I can forget, and never lose hope. It says on page 50 in the big book that this power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. I was completely without hope in those 7 years. And when I came back into this program, and I never dreamt I'd get my recovery back. But by following the instructions in the big book, like an instruction manual, I have got recovery back. And, you know, just never lose hope. If you're struggling, there is absolute hope. Just never, ever lose hope. So today, I absolutely know in my heart that if I'm not trusting and relying on my higher power, then I'm trusting and relying on food. and therefore our choice boils down to a faith in a higher power or a slow, painful death, and that is my truth. My name is Gail. I'm a compulsive overeater, and my tribe is OA. This is where I belong. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. And I think it's over to you now to explain the big book.
So, having heard my personal story of relapse, I think it's really helpful for us just to spend a little while looking at what does the big book tell us about relapse. So, Rita and I are just going to share some quotes from the big book which talk about this. So I think somebody's going to put the slide on. So yeah, right at the beginning, even before we've got into the main body of the book, the big book starts to talk about relapse. So the first one is, it says he suddenly realised that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. So talking about step 12 here before we get into the main body of the book, and that's really strong language, isn't it? In order to save himself, he must. So it doesn't say you might want to consider or you might want to think about, it says he must. And then it moves on to say strenuous work, one alcoholic, one compulsive overeater with another, was vital to permanent recovery. And without doubt, working with others brings me closer to my higher power. I can absolutely feel that when I am working with other people. It's just incredible. And, you know, vital means above all else. And that is why it's so important if we want to keep our recovery. And then it says, AAs had to hang together or die separately. We had to unify our fellowship or pass off the scene. And again, it uses really strong language. And that's just a really lovely reminder that this is a we program. My ego will tell me I'm different. It will tell me I'm not as bad as you, or, you know, I'm worse than you. And therefore, this program isn't going to work. But actually, this program will work if we do what it says in the book. And on page 13, it talks about belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty and humility, too many H's, to establish and maintain the new order of things were essential requirements. And again, you know, essential, strong words. And although I think willingness is really important, you know, I have seen this disease kill people while they were waiting for the willingness. So sometimes we just need to act. And then on page 15, it says, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic, another compulsive overeater would save the day. And I have been told that this is the solution to anything and everything. And, you know, if we're in a really, really difficult situation, if I'm in a really difficult situation, of course, I connect and pray to my higher power. But actually, working with another compulsive overeater is equally powerful. And then on page 20, it says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help lose their needs. And that is because I lose that obsession with myself. And in those beautiful times when I am working with people, I'm just not even thinking about myself during that time because I'm so absorbed in the big book and the person that I'm working with. And then on page 32, it says, then he fell victim to a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink like other men. And that reminds me that I need to know my DNA. You know, I need to know that I am a compulsive overeater. And for me, I can never eat my binge foods without disaster. And, you know, I also have no control over whether I stay in fit spiritual condition. All I can do is do my part to try and stay in fit spiritual condition. And then on page 58, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And this is a recipe that works, but we have to follow the exact instructions. You know, if I was making a pair of curtains, which is highly unlikely because I can't sew, yeah. But if I was making a pair of curtains, I would have to follow the instructions absolutely to the letter. Otherwise, I would end up with a really odd looking pair of curtains. So this is a recipe that works, but we have to follow it exactly. And then on page 63, it says he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. And
That's what I talked about in my share. This is the contract that I enter into with my higher power. My higher power will do for me what I can't, but I have to do those two things. And I'm going to hand over to Rita now.
Thanks, Gail. So in the next slide, I'd just like to say I wouldn't trust Gail to mount my curtains, but I'd definitely trust her to hear a step 10. So we're going to move into the big book warnings. So this is into action. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest in our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do. For alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And what's really important to remember, our disease, the disease of compulsive overeating, theism, the addiction, is a liar. And when your emotional side goes up against your intelligence, in my experience, the emotions always win if we're not in fit spiritual condition. And it is really easy to let up on our disease because we have a disease of forgetting. We have amnesia, you know. And it says very clearly in the book later on, faith without works is dead. We have to work at this 24/7. And you hear a lot of meetings, people would count their days and stuff, but really, I mean, we're coming both, you know, up to a few years, but it doesn't really matter because when you go to bed at night, you wake up untreated again and you have to start the day all over again. And then the next three quotes are very, very close to my heart. Like Gail, working with others, this is really important to me. Step 12, nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. And what I love about this, Dr. Silkworth talks about it being an altruistic movement. You know, this gets us out of self. If I find myself irritable, restless and discontent, I know I need to do the next right thing. I need to do something, as Gail said in her story, something that makes me uncomfortable with service. And people often say you do a lot of service. And I do, actually, I do. I find that I'm really busy and I find sometimes I have to step 10 it. But it beats what I used to do, which was put my head in the fridge and then losing a whole week, you know. It says, again, helping others is a foundation stone of your recovery. Again, you know, this is what we've got to do. I've got to say please in the morning, thank you at night, and in between try and help my other compulsive overeaters. You know, I had a really busy job before I retired, and I still sponsored. Maybe not as much. I wasn't able to give the time that I can give, but I do it. And sometimes I find myself when I'm reading the big book with people, I think, oh, if we could just skip ahead. But you can't skip in your recovery, and I can't skip on other people's and what I want to give to them either. And it says, keep on the firing line of life with these motives, helping others and God will keep you unharmed. This is keep staying in the middle of the hair and always look at your motives. I often look at my motives of self-seeking, particularly as a really bad defect for me and impatience. And I look at things, do I want somebody to like me more? So is that why I'm offering to do it? You know, I've got to think about my motives and everything I do. And then we move on to the wives. These are chapters often that you're overlooked in the big book. And I think when you read them first, it's kind of like, what are they on about? This is years ago. They sound sexist and archaic, I suppose. But really, we can find ourselves in these stories. That's a great thing about the big book. No matter how out of date it seems, it just transports you back to today when you think about your addiction. So it says, the fact is that he should work with other people to maintain his own sobriety. Here we go again. We're just getting messages about working with other people, sponsorship, sponsoring, why it's so important. And it's not even, I think at the beginning, people think, how do I stay well? Just offer to read the steps at a meeting, offer to time, offer to do things that don't require abstinence, because it's making you concentrate. I found for me, I get very distracted. I was saying before we started the talk, very easily, if there is a car alarm going off in New York, I think it was mine. It's just one of those things. I've always been like that as a child even. And I found the timing a very good thing for me because it helped me focus on the meeting and it helped me think, right, you know, it makes you listen, basically. So, and we'll move on. Next two quotes are out of the two employers. So to get over, drinking will require a transformation of thought and attitude. We had to place recovery above everything. And I'll say, for he knows he must be honest if he would live at all. And this is the most important thing. Recovery has got to come first. But to get that, we have to have a strong connection with the higher power. So we've got to transform it being I to the tune of me. It's got to be, what will God do? And very often sponsors will go, I was thinking of doing this, what's God saying? Because my annual sponsor of mine used to say that to me, what does God think? And now I ask him first. I go, for me, it's a hymn. And I say, you know, it's a tradition, God, but I say, what should I do about this? And if I don't know, I use the pause method, which is prayer and use spiritual energy. I just pause, because I reacted to everything before that. You couldn't have shut a door and I would have reacted. Do you know what I mean? It just, I had a comment about everything. And now it doesn't happen. If I'm having an off day, if I'm not in fit spiritual condition, sometimes I still try and run the show. And then we'll go to the vision for you. They had to give others what they found or be sunk. And I've written next to this, I wrote a wee note next to this, and I wrote, don't be a robber. I see this a lot in the rooms, and I've done it myself in the past, you know, come in, suck up all the recovery, and then you don't help anybody. That's where the circle stops, and that's where you fall off the cliff that Gail talks about, but you don't see it coming. Because when we start not thinking about others, there's only going to be one, we're not going to be thinking about, well, the odd time I'll be thinking about Tom Hardy or Brad Pitt, but pretty much most of the time it'll be about me, I can tell you. You know, and then it goes on to say, you've just tapped a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. Consistency will trump intensity every time. In the same as the disease, you do the same thing over and over. That's the definition of insanity. But in recovery, you do the same thing over and over and keep growing that. You will have recovery, and your recovery will stick, you know. And I wrote here, I'm not big on the slogans in a way, but I do love that it works if you work it, and faith without works is dead. I've got to get out of God's way, because honestly, on a bad day, I will stand, like for those of you who remember the American footballer, the refrigerator, I will stand there and nothing, or the rock in modern times, nothing will get past me. Do you know what I mean? And I would wrestle God to the ground and just walk over him, you know, so I have to get out of his way. And honesty, I have to always remember to be honest. So I think we'll move on to the next slide, which is our writing exercise for all you guys, because we've talked enough. So for this, you get 5 minutes. I think Donna is going to time the 5 minutes. So have a look and think about what your personal warning signs of relapse be, and then we'll ask you to give we'll have feedback for 10 minutes. You can raise your hands and just give us a couple of pointers. For me, it's not doing my step, my inventory. It's not owning my step 10s. It's not throwing, you know, when I'm resentful or fearful, not having a strong food plan, eating out a lot, changing what I'm eating, you know, just things like that. So have a wee think, and we'll leave that now for the next 5 minutes, and then we'll call on you to, Paul will call on you to feedback. Thank you.
Back over to Rita at this point.
Hi, thanks for that, Paul. They were really good, weren't they? They were awesome.
Fantastic.
I have to say, and thanks for the honesty for people who shared stuff that they haven't shared. I could relate to every single one of them, especially the funny, the last person you mentioned about weight. I mean, the scales are, you know, we use, I think when you're sick, you use the scales for affirmation, but when you're well, they're for information, you know, and we always have to hold on to that and remember that. So, and the next slide that we're going to put up is the big book, Wisdom. What does it say about relapse? What do we hear about relapse? So it says, in the foreword to the second edition of Alcoholics Who Came Into AA and Really Tried, 50 got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapse, and amongst the remainder who stayed on, didn't leave, but stayed on with AA, showed improvement. And this shows, because it goes to kind of what Gail was saying in her story, the sheer hopelessness of this disease. I think when you're in the food, the hopelessness, you have to get the hopelessness almost to get hope again, because that's when you finally believe there'll be a chink of light, you know. And then in Bill's story, we hear, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and nourish his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trails and low spots ahead. Life is really difficult. I'm a cancer survivor. You know, things will happen. I grew up in a war zone. Things happen that will make you eat. But you know what? Opening my eyes in the morning was what made me eat, really, because I have a disease of compulsive overeating. And if I don't work with God in the covenant, that contract that Gail spoke about, I will be sunk, because I will just believe the disease, and my disease is a liar. And liars always win, unfortunately. So, you know, that's where I have to make sure I have to fit every day. I have to hand it before my feet even touch the ground. My day has got to be handed over to my higher power, because when I try and do it myself and take the reins, I'll go off that cliff. And then, and there's a solution that talks about, if you're seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. My relapse taught me that I drank, I ate like Bill drank. I saw it a bit, in the first my first recovery, but the relapse really showed me where the food could take me, and it took me to places I never thought I'd go, you know. So I am serious. For anybody out there who doesn't think that my story isn't serious, you know, I was a massive compulsive over. I am, you know, in recovery now, by the grace of God, one day at a time. But back in the food, it was horrendous. And then in more about alcoholism, we learn, it says, if we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol or immune to our alcoholic foods. And for me, the definition of lurking in the book, it says, I love definitions of wording. So it says, remaining hidden, so as to wait an ambush in a latent state, although still presenting a threat. And it's that waiting, I think of it like the lion outside, you know, my house prowling around waiting for me to, you know, go into the garden. That's my disease for me. And it was the lurking notion that brought me down.
Okay, so now we're going to go into Rita's story. So I am really delighted to welcome Rita to share her story. So Rita has been around in OA since 2003. And I actually heard about Rita before I met Rita, because at my very first meeting, which was a tiny, tiny meeting, there was just three of us. I was told about this really big meeting in Manchester, in the city, and about this incredible woman there who'd had amazing recovery. And I actually went home that night from that meeting, and I wrote in my diary, gosh, this may work, this may actually work. And that was because of this inspirational woman here who sits at the side of me. So over to Rita.
Thanks so much, Gail. Okay, guys, for those of you who don't know, my name's Rita Q. I am a recovered compulsive overeater, and I say that not with arrogance. Somebody taught me to say that, because I say that for the disease, you know, I say that for the disease, not for anything else. I grew up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Towards the end of the Troubles, I managed to get to see the beginning of the peace process happening before I left to come to England. I came to England when I was 18. I'm 47 now. That sounds awful. When I think about that now, it seems like so long ago, but it feels like yesterday. I came to England to study French and Spanish, and yeah, so I'll go through my story. So I'm going to read this out. I know this paragraph off by heart, but I don't want to make a mistake. And it's in the doctor's opinion. And it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. Their alcoholic lives, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And then it goes on to say about how you succumb again and again, and you get locked into that cycle. You know, to get the ease and comfort, this is repeated over and over. And it clearly says, unless you have an entire psyche change, it's not going to work. So I just wanted to share what I had said before. I have always been a compulsive overeater. I hear people in the room saying, you know, it's when I'm this, that, and the other. No, for me, it was from the year dot. I grew up in a family of four brothers. We all ate like mad. You know, we had meal times were very important because of what was going on in the outside world. We had to be home for tea, make sure everybody was there. We were all safe. And it was always like, just, it was a big deal. And food became a comfort for me very early on. You know, talks about, you know, Bill says that alcohol was his master. Food was my master. It was my best friend, lover. You know, everything, it followed me everywhere. And I went away to boarding school, actually, and I hated it. I got really badly bullied, and I absolutely hated it. And I just ate more and more. And I noticed my portion sizes were bigger, but I did a lot of sports, so it didn't matter as much. And then when I came to England, I never drank alcohol until I was 18. I am not an alcoholic, but it is a gateway for me. If I drink alcohol at all, I won't eat. I am a compulsive overeater, and I will want to eat to the day I die if I'm not in recovery. And I genuinely didn't know, even at 350 pounds, let me tell you, for those of you who are English on the phone, that was 25, around about 24 stone. I did not know I was a compulsive overeater. I just thought I was a greedy bugger who liked a lot of Pringles. That was it, you know. And I realised, and it talks about that, the sense of ease and comfort that food gave me. I could see what the food was doing for me, but I couldn't see what it was doing to me. I needed it to get that sense of ease and comfort, but it was only a sense. the thing about sense, you can get a sense of a smell. It's not definite. It's not concrete. There's nothing there. So, you know, in England, then, I did my degree. I had a great time. You know, I did a lot of exciting things. I traveled the world as well. I did have a good life. You know, a lot of people, step one, you're powerless over food. We are powerless over food, but we're not helpless. There is a solution. It tells you that in the book, you know. And I had my, when I came into OA, eventually, it was because I got diagnosed with an autoimmune disease in 2002. I started chemotherapy. They put me on a whopping dose of steroids, which is the equivalent of giving a lot of methadone to heroin addicts, you know. And I just could not stop eating. And I mean, I would have eaten my husband if I could have got him into my mouth. And it was horrendous. You know, it was just constant. And I was home in Ireland for Christmas, and my sister-in-law, who's gorgeous, she just said to me one day, she said, "Are you okay? You haven't stopped eating." And I was mortified. I thought, I can't believe she noticed. I was 350 pounds. Of course she noticed. I had almost weeping stretch marks. And I was like, what's going on? And I just thought, one of my brothers who I'm very close to had mentioned OA to me years ago, and I completely discounted him. I thought, I'll do this with the PM ways. I'll do this with every other stupid diet that you can think of. And I did. I did. I lost weight. Do you know what? All I did was send my weight out for reinforcements. It came back with a lot more friends, and I ended up way, way up the scale again, you know? So I just thought, right, I'm going to try this away out. And I went, I was really excited. I thought, oh, great, I'm finally going to be the smallest person in the room. And I was all worked up. Thinking, I went in, they were all thin. And I thought, I'm a 100-pounder. You know, I had a lot of weight to lose. And I thought, oh, come on. Why are they all thin? And then then they started talking. They're talking about eating out of bins. And I thought, I don't do that. And then I realized, I didn't eat out of bins because I didn't have to, because it never, I was a bin. I was a human trash can. I was Oscar out of Sesame Street. You know, just give it to me. I love it. And then I realized, I began to hear things. So at the first, I didn't do the binge food thing. I have a really good little pamphlet for anybody ever wants to get in touch with me. It's not a way of brief, but it's very good. It sort of gets you to look at the ingredients that you're having. So at first I thought, I heard, don't have any sugar. So I thought, right, I'll only have sugar when I eat out. And then all of a sudden I realized I was eating out all the time. And my husband said, we seem to be eating out an awful lot when I joined OA. And I went, I'd never noticed, really. You know, one of those, like, I shouldn't be going to Vegas. I am a really bad poker player. I was just like, I hadn't noticed. You know, of course I'd noticed. I'd manipulated the whole thing. My disease and I had manipulated. I was having dessert. And the poor guy, it was like having dessert with somebody on the Titanic, because I'd say, oh, let's share a dessert. And I'd be sitting there interrogating him, like somebody out of the CIA going, why aren't you having a dessert? What do you mean you don't want a dessert? I want a dessert. Why don't you want, you know, it'd be like this, on and on. And the poor guy'd share it. And like all of a sudden, the table would be like a complete recess coming over to me. It would be like, no, I'm going to take it. So all this went on. And then all of a sudden, I thought, I'm going to stop that. I'm going to knock that in the head. So I'll just ease myself off. I'll have a hot chocolate in the evening. And I did. We hot chocolate, you know, just before I went to bed. And then I hope it's okay to mention foods, guys, but I have to explain what happened. And then the hot chocolate was at lunchtime. But all of a sudden, it had gone to like tea time to lunchtime. And then at 11 o'clock, sometimes my secretary would say, do you want a cup of coffee? She'd go out. I'd be like, oh, I'm going to bring back a hot chocolate. And I was thinking, what are you doing? And then I realized, and that was key for me at the beginning, looking at my allergic foods, looking at what I can't have, looking at the foods that when I eat them, I can't stop, and I can't stop from starting. So I need to look at those. And anyway, I started working the steps and I did get good recovery. I had five or six, I can't even remember actually, I'm always chatting to Gail about this, 5 or 6 years of blissful abstinence, working a really hard job, you know, sponsoring, doing outreach, doing service. And we got married. It was lovely back in 2008. And we decided to go around our world on the honeymoon and everything was well. And actually, we had this discussion in the car earlier. I always attribute it to a flight that I took. But actually, I remember putting away my wedding cake to bring it back to work for everybody at work. And I remember it got on my finger. And I remember licking my finger. I'd never do that. But we were on a flight. This is a conscious decision. I remember we were on a flight from Vegas to LA. And this is the part the lurking notion came in. And I was sat in the flight and they put down one of these stupid snack boxes and I opened it up and I ticked no sugar on all the flights. And there was something sugary with the chocolate bar that I wouldn't even dream of buying, incidentally. Nothing I even liked. And I thought, oh God, this is all I'm going to have. I was only on a flight for 2 hours, but of course there was me thinking I was going to starve to death all of a sudden. And then I thought, oh, I'll just have it. I'll be grand. And I was fine, you know. But you know that chatter you get when you're a compulsive overeater and you're in the disease? That feckin' white noise, it's like trying to turn on a radio and it's like, I had that the whole time when I wasn't in recovery. You need to eat. You're a heap of shit. You need to eat. Oh God, you've eaten again. You're such a waste of space. Let's eat and I'll make you feel better. That was just going on all the time. And that had completely stopped in recovery. But that noise started again. And I thought, oh no. And that whole negotiation, somebody mentioned it earlier when they shared, eating out more, eating stuff that wasn't necessarily on my food plan, not the sugar. I stayed off the sugar. And I used to say that, but I haven't eaten sugar. Yeah, because I was loading up on everything else, carbs, everything. And we were, by the time we got to New Zealand, I remember thinking, by the time we got to Hong Kong, I remember they served us something in the room. They had this beautiful, honestly, I was sick of getting into beds with rose petals because every single one knew we were on honeymoon. And it was like, they always used to leave something in the room. And by the time they left something in one of the rooms, it was like, oh no. And I actually remember thinking, I'm going to eat that. And I really don't want to. And that was eating against the will that Gail talked about. I had ate against my will when I was in the food. I was sunk by the time I got back to the UK. And I did try on and off. I did try on and off to get recovery. But what we've talked about today is not being in fit spiritual condition and life happening. And those things collided in my world. Because I came back a couple of years later. My dad dropped dead really suddenly. My mum dropped dead. It's Mother's Day here today, actually. And my beautiful mum, who I was very close to, I have no children, I couldn't have kids because I had a lot of chemo. She dropped dead really suddenly. And then a couple of years later, I got stage 4 cancer. And I swear to God, I think to this day, I'm the only cancer patient who managed to put on about 80 pounds when she was having treatment. Everybody else has been really sick and I'm like, give me more. And they love me in the hospital. They used to feed me because I just kept getting sepsis all the time. So they just fed me and I had stage 4 blood cancer. And I thought, and I just ate my way through it. I mean, I still had a sense of OA stuff, but, and I was still very kind. But I was back, it was back to the self-seeking motives as well that we hear a lot about. I used to do stuff for people all the time. You asked me, I'll sort it out. I was a project manager. That's what I used to do. And I'll sort it out for you. But it was always at a cut. I never did anything with grace. It was always, well, what can I get about this? And they often say that resentments are deferred, you know, a resentment, what is it? Expectations are just a deferred resentment. The resentment's in the making. And even though I did stuff for people, I always wanted people to do more for me, Mac. You know, I have a disease and more. I want more. Give me more Netflix, more Amazon, more whatever it is. I have a disease and more. It's never enough. When I'm in the food or when I'm in, and I'm not practicing the 12 steps, I'm an ever, you know, I want more of everything. So I started to eat really badly and I got up to, on my first round, in my first recovery, which was easy. My first recovery was a gift. My second one, I've had to work my ass off for. But it was 140, I lost 140 pounds. I put on about 168 pounds in relapse and it's easily done. It's so easily done. And I just couldn't stop eating. And then I had a massive spiritual awakening. This does not happen for everybody. It's not, but mine had to happen this way for the simple reason God had to slap me around the face and nearly drown me because I could not and would not listen to all the rescue, the search and rescue he was sending me. I was like, yeah, I'll be there in a minute. Put the lifeboats down. I'll be there in a minute. I'm just finishing off this 12 pack of donuts. I'll be with you in a minute. Run on, God. That was me. I have two rooms in my house that are either recovery or disease. And what I used to do is I put God in the recovery room and I come back and he was a Santa Claus God. I have a strong faith, but it was always God, let me win the lottery. Let me be thin and keep on eating what I was. Let me marry Brad Pitt. None of those things happen, God, but that's okay. We can talk about that later in my step time. But life became tough and I had my ninth bout of sepsis. At this stage, the cancer was receding, which was a miracle. Honestly, it was a real miracle because I used to see like my funeral in people's eyes. They couldn't look at me. And then on the ninth bout of sepsis, I was in the bath. Now, if you're a really large lady or a large person and you have a bath and let the water go out first, it's a rookie mistake. I shouldn't have done that. I had no energy left, none at all. I was in a lot of pain. My bone marrow was killing me. I ended up, the water went out and I couldn't get up. And I was in a big hospital here. And I remember that, you know, the toggles you have to put to alert the staff that you're in trouble. And I thought, I could barely breathe and thought, I can't do it. I can't pull the cord because nobody is going to be able to lift me. I was 380 pounds. I thought, I started to cry. I was bald, freezing. And I started to cry and it was horrendous. And then I just heard really gently, you need to go back to OA. It wasn't me that said it. And I thought, yeah, I really do. But I thought, but I need to get out of this bathtub. So eventually I did, I got the strength, got up, got back into the wheelchair. I was in hospital, I think, for another, I don't know, it might have been another 10 days. And then I ended up a couple of weeks after that, I went back to OA, parked right outside the building, double yellow lines, which you're not allowed to park on, straight into the meeting. And that was 2 years ago. It's nearly 3 years ago to the day, actually. It's 3 years next month, I think. And that's when I got my recovery back, thank God. And I did it the big book way. So step one, I admitted I was powerless over food. I was completely powerless. Food had me. I couldn't stop thinking about food. I couldn't stop eating food. I had to get the right combinations. I had sweets, so then I would have something salty to counterbalance that. So then I had to have something crunchy because it was salty. And then because I had the salt, I had to go for the sugar again. It was just like this big cycle. And it was always, I'll never do that again. I'll never do that again. And then I walked back into the rooms of Way and I thought, oh yeah, this is what I really need to do. Because I knew the pain ways wouldn't, the only thing I hadn't tried was surgery. But I knew that bariatric surgery wasn't going to work because I knew what was happening up here. And no kind of surgery, unless I had some kind of brain transplant, was going to, you know, stop the ism. So I came back into Way and I started to work with the steps like my hair was on fire. And, you know, I always share, the Oxford group was kind of pre-AA. It's how the AA, where AA came from. And they had four impediments to recovery. A resentment, and I'll put these in the chat if I can later. A resentment you won't get rid of, which is your step four. A secret you won't tell, which is your step five. A vicarious thrill like gossip, step six and seven. I love to gossip. Not now. I can't. I still try, but I know it's not right. I get that feeling from God and he's like tapping me going, I'm like, please, just this once. And then a restitution you will not make, which is steps eight and nine. So the pain of overeating has to outweigh the pain of letting the food go. I always say that. I heard that once before from a speaker. And like Gail said, I'm telling you stuff that I've heard in other rooms as well. And, you know, nowadays, and I talk to sponsees about this a lot, anything you've got to grieve, negotiate or barter this on your food plan, anything that you even have to discussion with me about, you know you're in trouble. I have never had so many discussions about peanut butter at the beginning of lockdown as I did with a sponsor in my life. I think I spoke about it 1 week about 20 times because people kept coming to me and saying, I've just noticed. And it's like, you need to look at what it is you know, what is keeping you from God? Because everything that you try and add in, the Netflix, the shopping, love to shop when I give up the food, it's that blockage to God. It's like those space, you know, when you see them on space, they're NASA, you saw them going out onto the moon with the little string that was helping them breathe with the oxygen. That's God to me. And people say abstinence is the most important thing. No, my conscious contact with God is the most important thing in my life, because if I don't have that, I will not get abstinent and I will not work any of the steps. And I won't be sitting here today. I've been there watching Billions, not caught up in the latest episode. So outside issue. So, and then it talks about the absolute honesty. Is it true or false? And two, unselfishness. How will this affect my other fellow? Am I doing the right thing, you know? Three, the purity. Is it right or is it wrong? And four, love. Is it ugly or is it beautiful? Is what's going to come out of here going to help somebody and be nice, or is it going to be nasty? Is it going to be the nasty in the food person that I don't recognize, you know? So anyway, just to get back on track, I came back, worked the steps like my hair was on fire. My sponsor left because they were on the front line at the NHS over here, and that was fine. I found another sponsor, worked slightly differently. I sponsor through the big book now. I make it really clear what I do at the beginning so that people aren't under any illusion of how this is going to go. Two things I know about God: I'm not him for sure, and he's definitely real in my life. So I leave people to, you know, find their own way with their food plan. I ask, I help them, I give them some hints, but, you know, I have worked with a nutritionist as well. So, you know, and I know what's good for me and I know what's not, you know, and I know, you know, like I said before about the emotional and the intelligence, my emotion will always win. So I need to really keep that in check. And the only way of doing that is the steps. So I do the steps every single day. And that's the circle that Paul refers to at the beginning. Before my feet hit the ground in the morning, I say to God, please take this day from me. I'm sorry for using bad language, but I actually say take this SH1T show from me, because that is what I will do if I keep, you know, don't talk to God. You know, then step two, I just continue on. So the principles, you know, the principle step one is hope, is honesty, sorry. Two brings me hope. Three will bring me faith. So the simple step one to three is giving up. it's surrendering, powerless. 4 and 5 is courage and integrity. 6 is willingness. So 4 to 6 are the cleanup steps for me. Then 7 is humility. 8 and 9, self-discipline and love. So 7 to 9 is making up. And then 10 is perseverance. 11, spiritual awareness. And 12, service. So 10 to 12 is when I'm growing up. And, you know, I have to admit my faults all the time. I have to do step 10. I get step 10s over the simplest of things. And I'll know where I am. Thanks, Gail. I'll know where I am in what I'm doing. Because one day I don't do all this work, I'll notice. But see, by 2 days, you'll notice for sure. So for me, it's about now, it's about into action every day, helping, you know, saying good, it's waking up and saying please in the morning, as I said before, thank you in between, thank you at night and in between helping the other compulsive overeaters. And I just have to remember, life isn't about getting what I want, it's about wanting what I have. And today I do have what I want. Sometimes I want a few more things. I was laughing, talking to Gail, saying, oh, I'd love to go here and I'd love to move there. But, you know, I don't have to act on anything today. You know, we had talked about ego earlier. Ego is 3 things. Make me right, make me different, and make me feel good right now. It's a quick fix, like the food. And every day I get up, I have to deflate that ego because that is the only way I can cope. I deflate the ego, I hand it all over to God, and then the humility will come in eventually. And I will hopefully be the best version of myself that I can be. I hope that's given some people hope. I've lost, sorry, just before I finish, I have released quite a bit of weight. I have still a lot to go. My biggest character defect is impatience, and that is fine. It's in God's time. I'm following a food plan, a strong food plan, and I'm doing the work. And I'll leave it at that. And thanks for listening, guys, today. And I'm going to let Gail take over. She's going to slide in now. This is seamless, isn't it, Claire?
Hi, okay, so we're going to do our second exercise of the session. So the writing exercise that's going to pop up on the screen now is, what actions can you take to get out of relapse if you are in relapse? Or if you are in recovery, what actions can you take to stay out of relapse? And we've got 5 minutes to do that.
And I think we pause the recording.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. And thank you for your fabulous contribution. That has been really, really, really great. Awesome. And so helpful to us to listen to as well. So thank you. So we've just got a couple of slides just summarising and closing the workshop. So as we've said throughout this workshop tonight, relapse is not part of everyone's story, but for some of us, it is. And, you know, I hope what we've shared tonight has given people hope that, you know, if you are in that place or if you're in the kind of on the edge of that place, you know, there is hope for recovery. And recovering and a rekindling of a relationship with our higher power is possible. And, you know, in that space when I was in relapse, I just felt completely abandoned by my higher power. And I had to really reinvent what I needed my higher power to do, because I was really struggling with, well, if I had a higher power, how come I relapsed? And that was my own distorted thinking. I relapsed because I stopped working the steps and I stopped actively working this program and following the instructions in the big book. But reinventing what I needed my higher power to do for me was really important. And actually, the longer I'm in recovery, the more comfortable I am with not knowing who or what my higher power is, you know, just kind of sitting in that mystery feels really comfortable. But what I do know is that I have a higher power in my life today, because I cannot do this. As I said in my story, I think it's vital to share experience, strength and hope, particularly when we're struggling, because shame can really keep us in bondage to the hell of this disease. And honesty is absolutely vital, no matter how we're feeling, no matter what behaviours we're engaging in. It says on page 65 of the big book, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. And then, yeah, the fear of more eating and more destruction must outweigh the fear of letting the food go. It must, or it will kill us. You know, it was incredibly scary for me to put the food down because it had been my crutch. I'd had a really passionate love affair for over 30 years with food,
but it was absolutely killing me. So I had nothing to lose. And I heard a speaker once say that, you know, in that moment, and I think this absolutely happened to me, in that moment, the voice of desperation spoke louder than my ego. And this was somebody who got sober in their seventh treatment center. You know, why had the previous six not worked? And on the seventh treatment center, this person got sober. And I think that's what happened to me. You know, how was I in the food one day, you know, coming to the end of a 7-year relapse and in recovery, abstinent the day after. And that's the only thing I can think of. The voice of desperation spoke louder than my ego.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And then just to move on, somebody's asked for contact details as well. We will put them in the chat. Stop asking why me. This is out of Crossing the River of Denial. It's one of my favorite stories, actually, in the big book at the back. It says, stop asking why me. It says, it's like a man standing on a bridge in the middle of a river with his pants on fire, wondering why his pants are on fire. It doesn't matter. Just jump in. And I hear that a lot, you know. Sometimes I would hear, oh, I can start after this, or, you know, that whole diet mentality of I'll start on Monday or Christmas is coming. And the thing is, the disease just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. It is cunning, baffling, powerful, and it gets stronger with time when it's untreated. And that's something that I never gave it credence for when I went into relapse, because at one point it felt like I was in a little rowing boat with this huge tsunami coming over me. And then in Window of Opportunity, another story, it says, looking back, that may have been the first healthy decision I ever made with respect to alcohol. One definition, and this breaks my heart because it's so true, one definition of a bottom is the point when the last thing you lost or the next thing you're about to lose is more important to you than the booze or the food. That point is different for everybody, and some of us die before we get there. A lot of people come into the rooms, a lot of people go. This disease will kill you. There is no, it doesn't want anything else, but it will settle for misery and to keep you in the misery. And then he lived only to drink. Page 451, I cannot allow my sobriety to become dependent on these ups and downs of living. Sobriety must live a life of its own. And Gail touched on that a couple of times, you know, and your sobriety has got to be separate to what's going on in your life. What we have is a design for living. When we are working the steps and using the tools to get up, you know, as a banister to get up the steps, we can deal with anything that comes between us because we have a design for living that comes to us. We can, you know, those highs and lows that it talks about, we can deal with them because we know what to do. It might mean a lot of calls. It might mean a lot of work on ourselves. You know, we might need outside help as well for certain issues. That's okay. But the steps are really clear what we do. And isolation, the disease wants us isolated. So we have got to talk to fellows, keep, you know, working the God Squad. And then the appendix, on page 57, it says the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself, learning to depend upon a higher power and absorb himself in his work with others, with other alcoholics. He remains sober day by day. These days add up into weeks, the weeks into months and years. And we're both very blessed it has done that for us. But that's only because we work it. And, you know, we have to get out of self. I will want to have an early night and a nice bath. You know, it's quite late here now for us. And for me, it's late because I normally go to bed about an hour ago. But this is just such a joy. And hearing all the feedback I've heard is a joy. And doing this service is an honour. It's just an honour because it takes me out of self. Takes me off Netflix. Not that I have time to watch TV anymore. But, you know, that's just, we've got to get out of self. I've got to get out of God's way, you know. So,
yeah. Okay, so on page 52 of the big book, we learn about the bedevilments. And what I think is really incredible is that if we follow the instructions in the intervening pages, we move from the bedevilments into the promises. So let's just show you how.
So I'm going to use this in the I form because we think it works better. So I was having trouble with my personal relationships.
And what happened when you worked the steps?
I lost interest in selfish things and again interest in and everybody else and our fellows. And I find that self-seeking will slip away and has done.
I couldn't control my emotional nature.
And what happened when you work the steps?
I now comprehend the word serenity and I know peace.
I was a prey to misery and depression.
And what happened?
My whole attitude changed and my outlook upon life has changed as well.
I couldn't make a living and making a living certainly didn't make me happy.
And what happened then? when you work the steps?
Fear of people and of economic insecurity has left me.
As I shared earlier, I had a feeling of uselessness from a very early age.
And after you'd worked the steps?
That disappeared, thank God. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity has disappeared.
I was full of fear.
And what happened now?
I now intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me.
I was unhappy, though it didn't seem it on the outside. Inside, I was dying.
And what happened?
Now, I know a new freedom and a new happiness beyond my wildest dreams.
I didn't seem to be able to really help other people.
And then?
No matter how far down the scale I went, I now see how my experience can benefit others. I do not regret my past and I don't wish to shut the door on it.
And most of all, we suddenly realise that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. So we're just going to finish on two quotes out of the big book that were both really spoke to Gail and I.
So the first one is Twice Gifted on page 475 of the big book. And it says, my physical being has certainly undergone a transformation, but the major transformation has been spiritual. The hopelessness has been replaced by abundant hope and severe, sincere faith. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous have provided a haven where, if I remain aware and keep my mind quiet enough, my higher power leads me to amazing realizations. I find joy in my daily life, in being of service, in simply being. I have found rooms full of wonderful people, and for me, each and every one of the big book's promises have come true. The things that I have learned from my own experience, from the big book and from my friends in OA, patience, acceptance, honesty, humility and true faith in a power greater than myself are the tools I use today to live my life, this precious life. Today, my life is filled with miracles big and small, not one of which would ever have come to pass had I not found the door of Overeaters Anonymous.
And I'll just go on to mine. And life is really precious. It's beautiful that you read that, especially in these times. And I'll just read mine. Is as it is, OA has filled my days with friends, laughter, growth, and the feeling of worth that is rooted in constructive activity. My faith and in contact with my higher power shines more brightly than I ever dreamed it could. Those promises I thought were impossible are a viable force in my life. I am free to laugh, all of my laughter, free to trust and be trusted, free to both give and receive help. I am free from shame and regret, free to learn and grow and work. I have left that lonely, frightening, painful express train through hell. I have accepted the gift of a safer, happier journey through life. And that is our workshop, hopefully. You find it beneficial. Thanks so much to everybody who showed up. Thanks for